What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin along with John Krofcik. And John, it is really something that we should celebrate. Yeah, let's celebrate. Yeah.
Woo! What are we celebrating?
Well, when we ever can beat back something that seems almost insurmountable, a habit or a tendency that we thought we could never break free from it. It had us enslaved in shackles, and we say we're finally free from it. And I think that's the way we have to think about smoking here in the United States in many ways.
Oh, I think you're right. I think we passed laws that people, you know, can't smoke in businesses. And so I think that's a good thing that we've done, and it's really helped, and it's hopefully helped people's health.
Well, when you look at it, the CDC estimates that 35 million American adults still smoke, but, I mean, we're at one of the lowest levels that we have been ever, about, I don't know, 14-15%, I think the numbers are. Maybe I've got those wrong, but we'll be certain to get those updated and corrected as part of our interview in just a moment. But having said that, there is this worry that these e-cigarettes and vaping, which we've talked about here on the podcast, America Trends, is something that might encourage young people to think again, in a good way, about the process, at least, of having this stick in your hand or something in your hand that you're puffing on.
Well, it's not only that it's a stick, but they can make them look like anything, you know, so they can, you can hide them pretty well. So it's kind of a strange thing.
But I remember talking to somebody who was a major public health guru back about 6, 7, 8 years ago, and he thought it was a great idea. He thought that this would help to wean people off of at least tobacco, which is the more noxious of that which you know, develops all these health hazards, and that nicotine, well, at least, you know, it wasn't as bad as smoking tobacco. So I thought about that. I kept that tucked away for many years. And then all of a sudden started reading about vaping and began to wonder, well, is this really a good substitute? Are there better ways? And we interviewed someone recently in New York who had this sense that we were introducing a lot of young people to smoking as a result of this, and that it was not a good thing. However, on the program today, we have Dr. Joel Nitzkin. And he really believes that, in fact, we've got it right, that as part of a complement of things that we do to help people stop smoking, that vaping is actually a good thing, these e-cigarettes.
But if we're making them so that they're fun stuff, and I know they have different flavors and stuff, they make them very, you know, especially to kids. I mean, you know, they have all these watermelon and all these
cherry,
crazy, yeah, I mean, all this crazy
orange
flavors.
Yeah, well, I know they do, and some states are trying to pull that up. But he's saying that he disagrees. I disagree. We all just disagree about whether, in fact, this is adding to the smoking rolls going forward, or whether it's just being used as a substitute by young people who would have had the tendency and the inclination to actually become smokers themselves.
And then you wonder about the vape itself. I mean, is that healthy for you?
I don't know that. Well, we're going to ask Dr. Joel Nitzkin to help us with this. So again, at the beginning, lots of people thought that vaping was going to be just a good new weapon in the arsenal to help people to control that habit in terms of smoking tobacco. Then there was a sea change in the thought process. And we do know that a lot of young people are putting lots of different products into it. And you don't know if some people are cutting it with this, that, or the other. Marijuana, of course. But, you know, this whole notion that those numbers that we have been so happy about and roundly applauded here in the United States about smoking as one of the greatest public health advances that we've seen in the last 50 years, are we reversing that trend? And it's good to hear somebody who thinks, no, we've got it right, and we've got a whole slew of measures people can take to stop smoking, but he thinks this is part of the arsenal.
All right, well, let's get him on. Let's hear this.
All right. Dr. Joel Nitzkin is with us, and he is a senior fellow for tobacco policy at the R Street Institute. And Dr. Nitzkin, from the CDC, we have some great news. Smoking is at a record low in the U.S. And let's dwell on that good news for a moment. If we have been able to score such a huge public health win with smoking, are the measures taken to accomplish this something that we might be able to apply in other realms like drugs, eating disorders, and the like?
Well, I think so. There are a lot of questions about our general approach to a lot of these public health problems. The one major debatable issue that we see on the smoking issue and with some of these others is the question of whether or not there's anyone in the private sector we could collaborate with to help drive this further. There are many individuals, and I have to admit I'm one of them, who, having reviewed all of the data as it's come out, honestly feel that the availability of e-cigarettes in the market have been a major factor in driving people away from cigarettes. And this is something that public health authorities have not acknowledged to date.
Well, it's interesting because I interviewed someone from Boston University many years back when e-cigarettes were just coming online. And he's a public health scholar, and he was very hopeful about them. But what we've been reading about them and hearing about them, and we actually did a podcast, is that they're, well, reigniting, if you will, smoking for a younger population, and that is worrisome. And the other thing that we're hearing is that there are many smokers who are kind of half and half. They're still smoking a bit, but they're also vaping. So what are you finding?
Well, what I'm finding is that dealing with the second part first, what they call dual use, is a natural transition period for many people who want to switch from cigarettes to e-cigarettes or other vapor products, where there is a period of time, sometimes just a few weeks, sometimes measured in months, where they smoke fewer and fewer cigarettes as they consume more and more e-cigarettes, eventually leading to 100% e-cigarette use, but it's not immediate. And all of the data I have seen indicates that when somebody is a dual user, they are substituting e-cigarettes for cigarettes. In other words, they're consuming fewer and fewer cigarettes. It's not on top of the same number of cigarettes they'd been smoking previously. Now, in terms of the data from the younger population, especially in the case of Juul, there are a number of interesting and unanswered questions. First of all, the vast majority of such use by these kids is one-time or occasional experimentation. And the data that's been released and shared by CDC calls that current e-cigarette use. Well, if a kid hearing the hype tries it to find out what all this excitement is about and doesn't continue, that's not continuing use. And with a number of the vapor devices, previous data, this is before Juul came out, indicated that only about 20% of the kids who vape nicotine. A large number of them, they just flavoring, and they do it on a recreational basis to see who can generate the biggest vapor cloud. And in states where marijuana has been legalized, a large number of the vapers are vaping marijuana instead of nicotine. There are a whole number of questions here, and I haven't seen any evidence that e-cigarettes are attracting non-smoking kids to nicotine addiction. As far as I can tell, that hasn't happened. Now, there's an interesting change in FDA policy. They have released every year through 2017 an extensive data set on who's using the e-cigarettes. For 2018, they have not released most of those data. And they've spun the data they have released to suggest to people that e-cigarettes in general and Juul in particular is attracting large number of kids to nicotine use. Well, the data from all the prior years indicates that the vast majority of such use is by kids who are already smokers. The vast majority is by non-smokers is just experimentation.
Mm.
And the numbers of non-smokers who use any kind of vapor product more than 20 days a month has been less than 1% of the kids. So this is hardly an epidemic. And we are puzzled by the fact that FDA and CDC have not released these details. So there's a lot of concern among those of us who basically have been convinced that e-cigarettes have a role to play in not only reducing harm in adults, but reducing nicotine addiction in kids. We're very concerned about why CDC has initiated this campaign without publicly releasing the data that would justify this declaration of an epidemic.
What are the best approaches to cessation? I mean, you're talking about e-cigarettes in a rather positive light, but there are other techniques. What do you think is really the most effective way for somebody who's still smoking?
Quitting cold turkey has always been the best and the most effective way. The nicotine pharmaceuticals have consistently been the least effective way. Because what happens when somebody uses especially the nicotine substitutes is that during the initial 3 months when they're on the product, about 40% of the smokers do without cigarettes. But if you look at them 6 months to a year later, less than 10% are abstinent. The numbers are a little bit higher for Chantix and Zyban, but not a whole lot. And the problem with those products is that, you know, they deal with smoking as if it was a disease, not a behavior. Well, for some it is a disease and an addiction, but for most it's a behavior. A one-time treatment and then discontinuation of that treatment is just not an effective way of dealing with it. The real value in any of those pharmaceuticals is if you just use them on a continuing basis as a substitute for cigarettes, in which case you're using it for harm reduction. And the e-cigarettes are more palatable, more satisfying, and a whole lot less expensive. And as far as we can tell, they pose no more risk than these pharmaceutical products. So we're very concerned about a lot of the hype that we're seeing. And we're very concerned that if this continues and if, you know, the tobacco control authorities go through with their threat to just eliminate e-cigarettes from the markets, we may see cigarette smoking spike again.
Hmm. I mean, do you believe that smoking really is at a record low? I mean, are we to believe the numbers that have come from CDC? They're telling us about 14% of U.S. adults are current smokers. But they're also telling us that the mortality rate from smoking has yet really to drop. I mean, what's going on there?
Well, there are a number of questions about the data. Number one, I do believe that the prevalence of cigarette smoking has dropped to the level they quote. And there's also data, which I also believe, that those who are continuing to smoke are smoking fewer cigarettes. The data that they quote are basically data that are generated by a now 20-year-old software program called SAMIC. There's reason to believe that the actual mortality is probably 30 to 50% less than generated by the SAMIC software. But only CDC has got the data to sort of confirm or deny these impressions. Now, we have information from the Heart Association that cardiac deaths are down 50% compared to several days, decades ago. We have data from the Cancer Society showing that lung cancer deaths are way down. But when you take a look at what CDC says about smoking-related deaths, they don't show those same reductions. So there are a number of concerns, and you also have to keep in mind that there's a 15 to 20-year lag between when somebody starts smoking and when they might die of a cigarette-related disease.
Mm. Why do most people who try to quit fail? I mean, I'm reading a number like 90%. And you've got so much less pressure today to smoke. So many fewer people are doing it. And it's getting harder and harder as a societal thing to continue this habit. So why is it so difficult? Is it an addiction or did you say more of a habit?
For a number of people, it does meet the definition of an addiction, where if they quit, they experience withdrawal symptoms. Now, there's a difference between cigarettes and e-cigarettes in that cigarette smoke contains a number of other chemicals within it that magnify the addiction. In fact, they include some chemicals within it that are used for drugs for psychiatric patients. And those aren't present in the nicotine-only preparations. So by definition, the nicotine-only products appear to be easier to quit. And the data available from surveys in adults in Europe paint a picture of, number one, the vapor products being the most commonly used successful product to discontinue smoking. And after people quit smoking, after another 2 to 3 years, about half of those e-cigarette users have also quit use of e-cigarettes. Now, there's no support in the United States for surveys of that type here. These data are only available from Europe, but we have no reason to believe it would be different here.
In general, how is the U.S. faring as it relates to the smoking population? And can we attribute it to the public education efforts, regulation of the advertising industry, or a combination of things that came together to really push out what, if you watch anything today that's on television that represents the 1970s, as I've been watching certain programs, it's unbelievable to see the amount of smoking. You forget how prevalent it was.
No, the public education programs combined with the taxation and the restriction of smoking in many public and private areas has played a major role and has brought smoking down to, you know, levels of less than half of what they were in the 1960s before the advent of the e-cigarette. Now, since the advent of the e-cigarette, we've had the e-cigarettes as substitute for smoking. We've also had FDA come in and basically generate even more in the way of educational programming and even more in the way of regulation of stores that sell e-cigarettes illegally to minors. And it's hard to sort out how much of the accelerated reduction in smoking prevalence since 2011 has been due to the ever-increasing popularity of the e-cigarettes and how much of this has been due to traditional tobacco control programming. I think it's possible to explore those issues, but the correlation between the increase in e-cigarette use and the decrease in both adult and teen smoking and the reports that we get from vapers, from people who've used these products, gives a lot of credence to the idea that the e-cigarettes have played a major role in driving down both the prevalence of smoking and the number of cigarettes that smokers use.
Now, the FDA, as it relates to what is called tobacco harm reduction, I mean, explain what that policy really means in relation to nicotine and to e-cigarettes.
Well, tobacco harm reduction means satisfying a smoker's urge to smoke with a product that is far less risky than cigarettes. And when we talk about risk, we talk about risk of cancer, heart disease, and lung disease. And we also talk about possibly reduced risk when used by pregnant women. So that's what harm reduction is about. So the products that are proposed for harm reduction are not harm-free, but they are substantially less harmful. Now, there's another body of literature that shows that the addictiveness of the product is correlated with the harm of the product, so that those products that are less harmful are also less addictive, meaning that they're easier to quit. CDC's approach to date, and FDA has fully supported this, is that to them, smoking is a disease, not a behavior. And since smoking is a disease, and since their goal, their oft-stated and continue to be stated goals, a tobacco-free society, they basically see no role for any non-pharmaceutical nicotine product to try to achieve any public health goal. Their idea of tobacco harm reduction is asking people to use the pharmaceuticals that have been licensed as nicotine drugs on a long-term basis. And they have not engaged in any research to really study the efficacy of e-cigarettes and related vapor products in terms of efficacy for smoking cessation, or as a means of successfully diverting teens who otherwise would have become smokers away from cigarettes, and not only away from cigarettes, away from any long-term use of nicotine. Now, ironically, the Centers for Disease Control and SAMHSA, which is the federal drug abuse agency, run these elaborate annual surveys. And those surveys basically provide the best evidence we have from anywhere in the United States, showing that the e-cigarettes are used almost entirely by smokers, that is, for people who use them more than 20 days a month. And they appear to be diverting kids away from cigarettes, and they don't appear to be causing nicotine addiction in any more than a very tiny number of kids.
And nicotine addiction.
But these results are not presented in any of the CDC or FDA statements.
But nicotine addiction in relation to tobacco addiction, because a lot of us, you know, who don't smoke and haven't really been smokers, we think that the nicotine has a highly addictive result. But it's really more the tobacco? Explain it to us.
Smoking is highly addictive. Nicotine is much less addictive. Now, there's another factor here that people don't talk about. For a significant number of smokers, nicotine provides very important benefits. For people who have or have a tendency to either bipolar disease or schizophrenia, self-administered nicotine can play a major role in helping them think straight, in helping them control this noise inside their head so they can concentrate on what they're doing for both employment and enjoyment. So for them, those are very substantial benefits. And for them, the ability to secure the nicotine that they need so they can, quite frankly, so they can think straight, by a product that doesn't cause this horrendous risk of cancer, heart, and lung disease is a major benefit. Another thing that we have a disagreement with, you know, some of the federal authorities is their supposition or their statements to the fact that nicotine offers no benefits. There is well-established literature that shows that nicotine does offer these benefits. In talking to vapers, and even talking to smokers, you know, they smoke not only is their pleasure and they feel better, they can concentrate better, their memory is sharper. And so these are other issues.
Let's take a look at some health data that I think Stanford put out from the nation's 500 largest cities, and it shows that people who live in neighborhoods with the highest smoking rates are much more likely to be poor, less likely to be white, and more likely to have chronic heart and lung diseases. So there is a major socioeconomic aspect and racial aspect, seemingly, to who continues smoking and who does not.
Yes, there definitely is. And quite frankly, one of the reasons why, not only this, but all forms of substance abuse, alcohol and other drugs, if you're living the kind of life that's lived by somebody who's marginally employed, living under very uncomfortable circumstances, being able to use anything that even for a few minutes makes them feel better is something that they really gravitate to. And not only that, in those communities, they're isolated. They don't get the same health education and other messages that others get. And not only that, for a significant number of them where they think that life is brutal and short and there's nothing you can do about it, foregoing some pleasure today in return for a healthier and longer life is not something that they think about as being helpful to them.
What about taxation in that regard? I mean, would raising taxes on cigarettes to make them even more expensive, though I know they're wildly expensive, as I, you know, have heard these stories about what a pack costs today, is that anything that really acts as a major deterrent to smoking?
It acts as a major deterrent, but with limitations. I mean, the data show that if you basically double the cost of cigarettes, you can reduce the prevalence of cigarette use by about 20% for doubling the tax. But if the tax goes so high, you then create an opportunity for illegal and contraband products to be sold to undercut it. So people illegally import cigarettes from low-tax areas, or they manufacture cigarettes, sometimes in Indian reservations, sometimes just plain illegally, and that tends to substantially undercut the benefit of the taxes. Another factor, which is political, is once you get state and local jurisdictions dependent on cigarette tax revenues, they become less and less enthusiastic about taking other measures to reduce smoking.
And what are those other measures? For example, do many places have regulations aimed at limiting the quantity, the location, the type of tobacco retailers? What are they doing, or what else can they do in a municipality or a state really to limit access or interest or ease in getting cigarettes?
Well, one thing they can do is raise the age where, you know, you can sell cigarettes to somebody from 18 to 21. Now, before the Vietnam War, 21 was the age of majority, and kids under 21 could not buy cigarettes. But when these kids were being drafted at 18 years of age, it set up an uproar, and the age was lowered to 18, creating a situation in which cigarettes were then reintroduced into the high school environment. An estimated 14 or 15% of high school seniors are 18 years of age. And since they can legally smoke and bring smokes into the high school, that triggers smoking by even younger kids. You put it up to 21, you eliminate the cigarette use, you know, in the high school population.
And what is the number generally across the country in most states? Is it 21 or is it 18?
It's 18.
It is. Okay.
It's been 18 nationally. The Tobacco Control Act specifies 18 years of age and prohibits the federal government from mandating a higher age.
Hmm.
So there have been a number of cities and a handful of states that have increased it to 21, but I think for most of the country it's still 18. So that's one measure they can do. A second measure they can do is restricting smoking in public places and in places of employment. A third thing that they can do, and all these things have some level of effectiveness, is the taxation we talked about. Then there's health education, both general health education and quitline services, so that if somebody feels the urge to smoke, instead of smoking, they can pick up this line and talk to somebody who will, quite frankly, help talk them out of it.
Hmm. If we went from 46% of the general public smoking in, say, 1965 or 1970, and we're down now to about 14%, and we've got a lot of other problems in terms of obesity, in terms of diabetes and sugar intake and the like. I mean, do you think any of these are going to take on the concern and the proportion that the public education really began to deal with in terms of smoking? Do you think we're on the threshold of starting to deal with some of these other consumables in that way?
Well, what's happening in the better educated segments of our population, now this isn't a question of race or economic status, it is a question of educational status, those changes have already taken place. And there are a lot less obese people, and there are people with certainly healthier lifestyles. But in the case of tobacco, where this is also an issue, we have an added factor, and that factor is the voluntary associations and organizations that try to frame the tobacco issue as protecting our children against an evil industry that's intent on addicting them to a deadly substance. Now, politically, that is very, very strong. And none of these other problems have that or can make a legitimate case for that being a driver for their health education programming.
What about the strength of the tobacco companies? We know that in the past, I mean, they were very strong and they held a lot of lobbying sway. But now that they're not really part of the public conversation as much, their products aren't advertised in the way that they had been in the past. So are they still kind of front and center in the mind of policymakers and regulators, or have they kind of drifted into the background?
Well, they're very much front and center. And one of the things that's happened is they've put on these restrictions on advertising is that it has strengthened the market share of the major tobacco products that were already on top of the market and with established retail chains, and created a situation where it was very difficult for any smaller companies to basically break into the market. These cigarette companies don't collaborate with each other. They are fierce competitors. But they have each entered some form of low-risk product into the marketplace, some smokeless, some e-cigarettes, some what they call heat-not-burn products, where you heat a plug of tobacco but don't burn it to extract the nicotine and some of the flavor, because they feel that cigarettes are being threatened with obsolescence, that these vapor and these alternate low-risk products have the potential to make cigarettes obsolete. And one company has made which is Philip Morris International and Altria, makers of Marlboro cigarettes, have said, we want to get out of the cigarette business. We want to go entirely to these low-risk products. And here it creates this thing where nobody in tobacco control believes them. They still see them as this evil corporation. But I think what they are proposing to do is to partner with public health authorities, if the public health authorities will work with them, to basically make cigarettes obsolete.
Dr. Joel Nitzkin, a public health physician, board certified in preventive medicine as his medical specialty, and he serves as senior fellow for tobacco policy at the R Street Institute. I thank you so much for being with us today. Fascinating conversation about smoking and smoking cessation approaches. Thanks again for coming by on America Trends.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.